Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is wonderful, as always, to have your company for the show. Have you ever wondered why it's hard to change things in your life? Have you ever set a goal for yourself, made some progress, and then stopped doing the things you needed to do to achieve the goal? Or have you ever set a New Year's resolution only to not see it through? You know, by the time February comes around, you're kind of back to the old way of doing things. Well, you're not alone. It's a really common trait, and today we're going to unpack why that occurs. And my guest today is Dr. Gina Cleo. She is an expert when it comes to habits. She began her life as a dietitian. She's completed a PhD in habit research, and what she doesn't know about habits isn't worth knowing. So in our conversation today, we talk about what habits actually are, what's the difference between a habit and a behavior. We talk about how habits are formed. We talk about how to install healthy habits and how to uninstall those habits that no longer serve us. We also talk about the difference between habits and addiction, and then we talk about how to install workplace habits, how to create a culture based on the habitual way of doing things in an intentional way rather than by default. What sort of things leaders need to be thinking about, and what sort of things leaders need to be acting upon to install a healthy culture based on habits in the business. It's a really interesting conversation, and Gina knows a bucket load about this stuff. Now, Gina also has a new book coming out in June of 2024. It's untitled at the moment, but I'd encourage you to keep an eye out for it. It's going to be a really useful guide for people to understand habits. And in addition to that, she also has a 5-day free habit change course. So I'd encourage you to jump onto her website. We'll put the links in the show notes below, but jump onto the website and jump onto that course as well, because I think it'll really make a difference in your life if you're looking to install a new habit or uninstall an old one. Now, before we get into the podcast with Gina, I just want to mention to you some great news. If you've been tuning into the podcast over the last little while, you'll know that we've released the new Savvy Dentist magazine. It's a magazine that has been designed to be a business publication for dentists. It focuses solely on the business of dentistry. And we think that as the market evolves, that the need for quality business education is only going to increase. We know that traditional practice management paradigms of the early 2000s are outdated in the modern world. The market has become more sophisticated, the needs have become more complex, and as a result, we as business owners need to move and evolve with the market. We need to be adopting best practice, and the Savvy Dentist magazine is designed to give you another free resource to help you on that journey. The magazine is an extension of the podcast. In a sense, I've been thinking about the magazine actually since we launched the podcast, way back in 2016. The podcast has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of listens. It's been, you know, there's 400 episodes, of course, and it's been really, you know, well regarded and well received, which I'm deeply grateful to all of the listeners there who've downloaded and listened to the show. So my heartfelt thanks to each of you. The magazine continues in the tradition of the podcast. It's based on the idea that the best information that we can apply to our businesses will often come from outside of the dental profession. So in the magazine, we have lots of interesting articles from people outside of dentistry. We have experts in different disciplines, whether that be HR, recruitment, accounting, so on and so forth, to give you in-depth knowledge, in-depth understanding about topics that are very important to the day-to-day operations of your business. So the magazine comes out each season, so 4 times a year. The first edition is a digital version only. We did a limited print run for our Practice Max and Savvy Dentist clients, but after edition 2, or as of edition 2, it'll be available in print format for everyone. So if you'd like to get a copy of the magazine, either digital or print, all you need to do is head across to SavvyDentist.com, find the magazine tab, and subscribe. And whether it's digital or physical, it'll be totally free and we'll get that into your hands as quickly and as easily as possible. So I hope you find that really helpful. We're really proud of it. The first edition is live, and so head across to the website. We just can't wait to share it with you. But for now, let's get into our conversation with Dr. Gina Cleo. Here she is. Dr. Gina Cleo, thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us on the Savvy Dentist podcast all the way from the Gold Coast. How's things in your world?
It's wonderful, as the Gold Coast always is.
Fantastic. Gina, you began your professional life as a dietitian and you've since changed career. You've gone into an academic background of you've done your PhD in habits and understanding why we do the things that we do. I'm curious to understand about that transition, because as a dietitian, you know, what I think about from that point of view is we see so much knowledge, so much information in the world about how to eat well, live well, and yet at the same time we have an epidemic of obesity and other health-related problems. What is it that stops people from taking action on the knowledge that is readily available to them?
Yeah, such a good question. And that is pretty much the question that I had, which led me down the path of trying to understand why we do the things we do. There's so many factors that play into our behavior, and there's so many things that motivate us to behave the way that we do. One of them is knowledge, but there are so many others. There's habits, there's social norms, there's culture, there's emotions, there's all sorts of things. And what I realized, I guess, as when I was a dietitian, is I'm only really providing knowledge. But we seem to be having a major behavioral change deficit, not a knowledge deficit. So that's why I wanted to understand more about our behavior.
It's really interesting, because I think that's the same in dentistry as well. Most people know, don't eat crappy food, brush your teeth twice a day, floss your teeth, and yet, fluoridated water, all those sorts of things, and yet we still see dental disease rampant. What else contributes to behavior change? If I wanted to change behaviors, maybe, you know, it could be eating, it could be, you know, in our case, dental stuff, but just in life, because I think this is a really important topic through life. What goes into these behaviors? How are those norms established?
One of the biggest factors is values, is how much value we might place on something. So if somebody places a lot of value on, you know, their dental hygiene, they're going to put in the effort to floss their teeth and brush twice a day and do all the things. But if they value something like their time more or something else, they don't value that dental hygiene as much, they're not going to commit to all those things, even though they know it's good for them. They might just not really appreciate how important it is and therefore not take the required or the recommended actions. For example, like, I really value good sleep. I love having a good night's sleep, and I've got a caffeine sensitivity. So if I have too much caffeine throughout the day, it really impacts my sleep. And I noticed that when I was having dark chocolate in the evenings, it would impact my sleep. And so even though I love dark chocolate, I value my sleep more. And so that's something I've now eliminated from my diet.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a sad day in my world. I don't want to eliminate dark chocolate or any chocolate from my diet, but that's perhaps I don't have the same caffeine sensitivity. But I appreciate what you're saying about values, and I guess, you know, values is another way of saying priorities and what we place priorities on. Your priority is to have a really good night's sleep, because presumably that sets you up for a great day ahead, and you're able to focus on those other things. What I really wanted to understand is, man, this is going to sound really basic, but what is a habit? Because sometimes I wonder if we confuse certain behaviors with habits. Are all behaviors part of habits, or some kind of standalone behaviors that don't fit within the habit cycle?
Yeah, we use the words habits and behaviors interchangeably, but they are very different. So our behaviors are intentional. They're things like, how do I get from A to B, or where should I go on my next holiday? They're conscious, they're deliberate, whereas our habits, they are subconscious, they're automatic, they're mostly reflexive. And all of our habits were once upon a time a behavior. And as we repeated them over and over again in the same context, our brain started to go, okay, I'm recognizing that I'm doing this frequently. I don't need to think about this consciously anymore. And those behaviors get put into a different part of our brain, and they just happen automatically. So I say to you, if you think of like the very first time you learned to drive a car, you would have been focusing and using all your mental energy. Lots of cognitive resource goes into a task like that. And now you're probably getting to places and thinking, how did I get here? I don't remember driving. So the task of driving was once upon a time a behavior, very conscious and deliberate. And now there's parts and elements of it that have become habitual and automatic. And that's the difference between habits and behaviors.
What creates that reflexive nature? There's obviously some form of cue or some sort of trigger that has the whole reflex kick into gear. Can you just walk us through that relationship between the cue or the trigger and the habit itself?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called associative learning or Hebbian learning. And in neuroscience, if you think that, you know, there's a really famous quote by Donald Hebb, and it says, neurons that fire together wire together. Mm. So neurons that fire together, if you're putting a context and a behavior together, they fuse together and that becomes the trigger for the behavior. So for example, when you get in the car, the first thing you might do is put on your seatbelt. Getting in the car becomes the cue, and putting on your seatbelt is the habit. You don't get the urge to put on your seatbelt when you sit anywhere else, because that's not the context for putting your seatbelt on. It's the same with like getting up in the morning might trigger coffee, or might trigger brushing your teeth, or getting in the office might trigger turning on your computer and then checking your emails. So one habit feeds off another. But the other distinction between habits and behaviors is behaviors are not triggered by anything. They can be spontaneous and one-offs, whereas habits are always triggered. And that trigger can be something in our internal or external environment. So it could be the time of day, the place that you're in, the emotion that you're feeling, what you've just done beforehand, or the people that we are around.
That's really interesting to understand those triggers could be internal or external. So if I've heard you correctly, an emotional state could trigger a particular behavior or an action. So just to use an example outside of a professional sense, you might get home on a Friday night, you're tired after the week, something happens to tick you off. Are you maybe, I don't know if that's a habit or if it's just a behavior, you're perhaps more likely to get angry and irritated. Maybe that's not a habit, I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure if a Friday night fight kind of falls into a habit kind of thing. Friday night argument with your spouse.
What it might do is how you're feeling in that depleted state, you can have a habit of reacting a certain way. Mm. So that can be habitual. But what you're referring to there, Jesse, is something in psychology we call ego depletion. And what it is the depletion of your self-control. So there are so many things in our day that impact our self-control. So things like fatigue, sleeplessness, stress, being hungry or hangry, feeling negative emotions and making too many decisions. So of course, after a long, hard emotional day, you know, the last thing that we can really do is regulate ourselves very well. And we tend to fall back on old or bad habits. So you're more likely to go home and order some takeaway, binge watch Netflix instead of going to the yoga class that you promised yourself you'd go to. And yeah, you might snap at your partner. So you just don't have that regulatory resource that you would if you were in a more relaxed state.
I wanted to ask you, Gina, as well, about creating lasting change, because I'm sure, just reflecting on your work as a dietitian, I'm sure you had great success with your clients, your patients, who might have wanted to lose weight. But one of the things that I've noticed is people will change, get a result, but then once they've achieved that result, they revert to old behaviors and old habits and they gain the weight again in this particular circumstance. So I wanted to ask you, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard many, many times, you know, 21 days to create a habit and all that sort of stuff. Why is it that some behaviors stick and others and become habit forming and others don't become habit forming in that particular example?
Yeah. So the secret sauce to creating a new habit is consistency. And it takes longer than 21 days to change a habit, unfortunately. I know we've been told it's 21 days, but it actually takes on average 66 days to create a new habit. But it could also take longer, depending on how habitual you are as a person, how complex the habit is that you're trying to create, and how frequently you're actually practicing that habit. So if you're trying to change something that's a bit difficult to do, like let's say you're trying to, you know, do a whole bunch of push-ups in the morning, that's a complex behavior compared to, say, having a glass of water, which is quite a simple behavior. You're going to develop the habit of having a glass of water much quicker than you're going to do these push-ups, you know, in the morning. So that's one of the reasons our habits don't stick, is because we give up too soon. One of the other reasons is that we don't track our progress. So one of the key requirements to creating a new habit is using something called a habit tracker, or like a self-monitor. And we know that self-monitoring and habits really go hand in hand. And all it basically is once you've achieved your habit for the day, you tick off that you've done it. And that gives your brain this positive feedback loop, which is in a sense a reward. And your brain goes, oh, that felt really good. I acknowledged my win. And it strengthens those neural pathways in your brain and reinforces the habit for you to do it again. So that's another really important point. And the third one would probably be the lack of frequency and when you're exposed to the cue. So say that you say, okay, at 7 a.m., I want to go for a walk every day, and you only do it a couple of days a week. So your brain is used to seeing 7 a.m. equals walk. But when 7 a.m. comes along and you don't go for a walk, now your brain's like, wait, I don't know if this is an association now or not. And so the habit doesn't become strong and can fall away really easily.
Yes, I think I've been caught up in some of that in the past as well. And I guess that's why the New Year's resolutions don't always stick as well. You know, every January, everyone's making their resolutions for the year. And I guess that's part of the reason why they don't get past February or March most often. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the other points there is sometimes our goals are extrinsically motivated, not intrinsically, which means that extrinsic motivation means that we're doing what we're doing for someone else or for external rewards, whether that's acknowledgement or financial gain. But actually, we know that those extrinsic goals are only ever short-lived. We have to really want those goals. We have to really desire it ourselves. It has to be valuable and meaningful and relevant to us. Otherwise, it's really hard to do something for someone else for a really long period of time. We tend to just give up on it.
I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you as well is if you're looking to install a new habit, and I'll talk about how to uninstall a habit in a moment, but if you wanted to install a new habit, do you only work on one habit at a time, or do you start thinking, well, I want to do my morning glass of water and I want to do my push-ups and I want to do this? If you're consciously trying to create a better routine, a better rhythm, how many habits can and should you be, you know, trying to install at any given moment?
Our brain is only capable of making up to 3 changes at one time. So the golden number is 3. But we've also seen in the research that if you just focus on one thing at a time, you're actually much more likely to achieve that. And then you can move on to the next and move on to the next. It's really hard though when we're speaking to high achievers, and I really struggle with the idea of just focusing on one thing at a time. It almost feels tedious and like it's not enough of a challenge. So it also very much depends on the person and their capacity. Sometimes life is full and it's busy and we're making lots of other different changes, whether it's a new job or a new house. And that's when we need to reduce, you know, the goalposts and only focus on one thing. But if things are pretty cruisy, then yeah, you can change up to 3 things and focus on, you know, 3 habits at one time. That would be perfectly fine.
Okay. And what about if you've fallen into some bad habits? I know most of us have got 1 or 2 habits we'd probably acknowledge don't serve us as well. And we go, you know what, maybe the, you know, sitting on the sofa at night, you know, binging on Netflix or, you know, eating a bit of popcorn or whatever it is no longer serving me, but it's become ingrained, it's become a habit. How do you uninstall a habit? Is it, do you work on the cue? Do you work on the behavior itself? Do you try and, you know, move away from the reward that would normally come with that habit? What's the situation there?
Man, if you've only got 1 or 2 unwanted habits, you're doing very well.
Yeah.
You're like a prime citizen.
There's probably a couple more than that that I'm just not prepared to admit to them online.
To admit them, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
There are 2 proven ways to break old habits, and you've touched on them. You know, one of them is looking at the triggers, those cues. So if, for example, if getting in bed prompts you to check your phone and scroll on your phone mindlessly, and that's really impacting your sleep, then you know that getting into bed is the trigger for this unwanted habit. Now, you can't change getting into bed because you still need to get to bed every night. But bringing in that awareness and literally saying to yourself, when I get into bed tonight, I'm going to want to look at my phone, and then you can look at the behavior. Okay, so maybe I'll put my phone out of reach, or I'll put it in a different room. So being aware of your habit triggers for your unwanted habits is really important. If you can avoid the trigger, awesome. Like, I had a client I worked with who used to get takeaway every single day on his way home from work, and he wanted to break that habit. He really struggled. So I just said, can you just drive a different way home and just avoid the fast food chain altogether? And he did, because no trigger equals no habit, and he was able to break that habit straight away. The other way to break old habits is replacing your unwanted habit with a habit that you do want. So if, again, like, say, phone scrolling, you might say, okay, rather than looking at my phone, I'm going to read a book. And then you'd put your phone away and you'd have the book there on your bedside table ready. And that way, when you go to reach for your phone, you've only got the book to pick up.
Fantastic. Where does habit become addiction? What's that? What's the relationship between habit and addiction?
The difference between habits and addictions all come back to how much reward that we get from that behavior. Addictions give us a much higher reward than our habits do. And that's why we persist in doing them, even though they're not so good for us. So if you think of reward like a seesaw, and on one side is reward and pleasure, and on the other side is pain. Wherever we feel pleasure, we're going to feel a dip or like a come down. So if you're experiencing this huge hit of reward or pleasure from something, whether it's gambling, looking at your phone, smoking, drinking, whatever it might be, you're going to have an inevitable dip afterwards. And that's not going to feel very nice. And you're naturally going to want to look for the next hit of pleasure or dopamine. And that's why we get stuck in these cycles of doing things that aren't good for us, because we're really just seeking those pleasures. When it comes to habits, the rewards that we experience from our positive habits is nowhere near as high as the addictions, which is why addictions are so hard to shake.
Some people might have addictions to fitness or addictions to food or excessive use of their telephone, or whatever it is, as you say, smoking, drinking, gambling, whatever. Is the treatment of addictions then similar does it still mean you identify the cue and the behavior? Is it still similar to try and break an addiction as you would a habit?
There are definitely overlaps to the interventions and the strategies that we would use, but addiction generally requires external support. It generally requires like a physician or a coach or, you know, a psychologist or somebody else to help keep you accountable. Whereas in habits, with enough motivation, persistence, and consistency, you can really break any unwanted habit yourself.
Yeah, okay. So that's really interesting. So for the people who have just got some bad habits, that's something you can manage on your own. But for those people who've perhaps got a slightly more serious issue with an addiction to, as we said, smoking, drinking, whatever, then they're going to want to get some help from an appropriately qualified person to do that.
Yeah.
Now that we've unpacked what habits are, how they're formed, how to install them, how to uninstall them, the difference between habit and addiction, I wanted to ask you about workplace habits, because this is a podcast primarily aimed at business owners, and I wanted to go through some foundations and whatnot before we get into the business elements. Where do you see habits showing up in a business? What sort of things do you see in a whether it's a large business or a medium-sized business, habits that drive growth of a business? What are the healthy business habits that you might see in a business?
I think it comes down to the little things in your day. It's the organizational skills. It's like how you go about structuring your day, your energy throughout the day as well. Like, are you doing high cognitive tasks, then low cognitive tasks, or are you burning yourself out with high cognitive tasks all day and then sort of flatlining the next day? It's really in the little things that I find the greatest success, but it's also in the consistency of performing those little things. So whether it's, doing things on time or going to those networking meetings or doing those social posts, but doing them regularly and in a consistent manner, I find that those really simple things are like the best things that small businesses can do.
You've had the opportunity to work with some really prominent businesses, and you've had the opportunity to examine the leaders up close and personal, so to speak. You've had the opportunity to work with their teams.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of leadership qualities or team qualities, apart from you spoke about consistency, which is obviously very important, mm-hmm. what sort of ways do you see habits being integrated into the workplace? How do we as an organization integrate habits? We know individually we've got to look at the cue, the behavior, and then presumably the reward at the end of it. How do we do that if we want to install organizational habits? We've got a team of 5 or 10 or 50 or 100 people that we're going, we want this organization to have a habit. How do we get, you know, all those people onto the same page?
Yeah, so there are three ingredients that, you know, every behavior change really needs. And it's called the COMB framework, and it was developed by Susan Mickey at the UCL, University College of London. And those three ingredients are capability, opportunity, and motivation. The capability is, you know, can this behavior be accomplished in principle? Is it physically and psychologically, are the people capable of doing these things? And then we've got opportunity. Is there sufficient opportunity for that behavior to occur? Do we have physical opportunity? Is there a social opportunity? Like, is it acceptable? And then there's motivation. Do we have enough motivation? Both conscious, desired motivation, but then that automatic motivation, which is a habit. And we really need all of those things, capability, opportunity, and motivation, to drive change. Sometimes what I see is, you know, we might have like new software systems in place, but we don't have the sufficient training for those software systems. So then people just want to fall back on doing what they've always done because it's easier, even though it'd be much more efficient to use the new software systems. Sometimes there's no motivation in the staff because we haven't incentivized them enough, or we haven't given them enough autonomy to want to do those things. And autonomy is a really important point, because we know that in autonomy, we need autonomy and self-efficacy. Autonomy is like the desire to do it yourself, the choice to do it yourself. And self-efficacy is your own self-belief that you can achieve whatever it is that's, you know, put out for you. I particularly find, and the research certainly backs this up, is when managers tell their team, I'd like you to do this, in this manner, in this sequence, by this timeline, it doesn't work anywhere near as well as when a manager communicates the big picture goal and there's a brainstorming workshop session that happens with the team, and they get to autonomously come up with great ideas about how to achieve that ultimate goal.
So what do you think, as leaders of businesses, we need to be really aware of as we start creating habits in our business? Because habits ultimately form part of culture, and we want to create culture by design and by intent rather than by default. If we wanted to install healthy habits, you've spoken about the study from UCL there. Is there anything else that you think the leaders of the business need to consider as they're looking at culture, particularly the workplace behaviors, accepted norms, being mindful of I'm using the word culture in a corporate sense, but also being mindful of culture in the broader sense as well. What sort of things do you think business owners need to be aware of as they're looking to build that organizational culture by design rather than by default?
I think some things in a business are really important to automate, but I think a lot of it, when it comes down to culture and relationships and community, actually is the opposite. We need to be behaviorally flexible. And what that means is, you know, say you're a manager and you've got two people that you're working with, those two people are going to respond really differently to different styles of communication. And it's important to understand your team and understand how they're going to respond to the way that you speak to them. If you automate the way that you interact with your staff, it's not going to work. It's only going to work for some, but not others. So I actually think being behaviorally flexible and being willing to change things consistently is one of the most important things that managers can do in their teams. It's like, ask questions. What's working? What's not working? How can we do this better? Do you guys want weekly meetings or monthly meetings or fortnightly meetings? Like, what works for you? Because we are all extremely complex human beings and we all operate extremely differently. And for an employee to bring their best, it's going to require, you know, their own style and their own way of doing things, which is going to be different to their colleagues. So I think being open to that is really important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And when you've seen organizations do that, what sort of outcomes typically occur when you have that behavioral flexibility? What sort of tangible outcomes might the managers expect? Because one of the things that there'll be someone listening here will say, that sounds great, Gina. I love that idea. And I've still got KPIs or budgets to hit and revenue to grow and all those other kind of stuff that they've got to do. What sort of outcomes have you seen working with organizations that have adopted this? What have been the big picture payoffs for them?
Well, the biggest thing is staff retention.
Yeah.
You've got staff morale, less sick leave, just more staff satisfaction, essentially. Yeah. And that's going to then drive efficiency.
So keeping the team engaged, keeping them happy, keeping them on board, reducing team churn, which is a massive drag on productivity if we've got turnover of team. So keeping them on board there. And just one last question I can't help but ask. You've also, as I mentioned earlier, had the opportunity to work with many of the leaders of well-known businesses around Australia and beyond. Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the qualities that have led to those organizations achieving so well? I won't list them off because I know they're on your website, but I don't want to name drop on your behalf, but you've had the opportunity to work with really well-known, well-trusted, big brands in a corporate environment. Mm. Why do they bring you in and what have you observed about the success of those businesses?
They mostly bring me in to bring in a wellness perspective for their staff. When we understand our habits, that's when we can be empowered to change them. And the real beauty of understanding the theory of habit change is it can be applied to any area of life, whether it's your work or your health, your well-being, your relationships, you know, the way you do meetings is completely applicable. But it's also teaching. So one of the things that I teach a lot in the corporate space is the idea of ego depletion, or when we're running out of self-control, and how you really need to work with quality over quantity. It's not about the hours we're spending in an office, but the product that we're able to bring, or the outcomes that we've got. And sometimes understanding our own capacities can be so powerful, because when we're on a good streak, we can smash out heaps of work. But when we're sort of not doing so well, then it's okay to take that step back and ask somebody else to take the lead, or, you know, like just sort of share the load individually. So organizations bring me in to I guess, educate them around this, which obviously then helps, I think, people personally, and then that is going to have an overflow in the rest of their world.
Gina, we've covered a lot of material today. We spoke a lot initially about habits, what they are, how they're formed, how to install them, how to uninstall them, habits versus addiction. We've spoken a bit about some of the things you've observed working with, you know, the industry leaders around the country and beyond. I guess what I'd really like to ask you as we wrap up the conversation, if there's something that you think that every practice owner, business owner, person really should know about habits and the work that you do, what would be the one or two things you'd like to just make sure that if you could whisper in their ear that they really landed for them?
Yeah.
What would be the pearls of wisdom you'd share?
Change is simple, but it's not easy. And, you know, our brain has a real resistance to change. We don't like doing things differently. It takes energy and effort and time, and we don't like that. And that's perfectly okay to acknowledge. So I think my number one tip would be to start small. Change is extremely rewarding. If it's in the right direction, it can be incredibly rewarding. And it's extremely innovative. And it's important to consistently find ways to change, but I think it's also important to not overwhelm people with change and just start really, really small. And just communicate, lots and lots of communication. This is why we're doing this. it's a trial, you know, like, or whatever it might be, but just bring your team along the journey of change with you.
Jenna, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us. I think this is a really fascinating topic because it delves into so much about psychology, neurophysiology, you know, all the things that make us tick as human beings. And you alluded to the fact that we are complex beings. And I really appreciate having been able to decode some of that so that we can perhaps open up our own brain and have a little look inside and see what we can do to get the best out of it, and get the best out of ourselves and get the best out of our lives. And I'm deeply appreciative of the work that you do and deeply appreciative of the fact that you've taken some time to come and share it with us today. So thank you so much for doing that.
That's my pleasure, Jesse. It's been lovely to chat to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.